Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, everyone is a Beatles fan. George Harrison is dead at 58 after a battle with cancer. There was something special about the quiet lead guitarist. Harrison brought the sitar into pop music and the world a little closer together with his concert for Bangladesh. Embraced and adored by teeny boppers in the West, he turned to Eastern mysticism for inspiration.
We were talking about the space between us and the people who hide themselves behind us.
In this hour, a world now torn by a new kind of war remembers a man who was a new kind of musician for peace. First, in 1962, then 15-year-old keyboard player Billy Preston met the Beatles in Hamburg, Germany. Harrison and Preston became close friends, and in some circles, Preston became known as the Fifth Beatle. I asked Billy Preston about their collaborations and how he will remember his friend, George Harrison.
So George was, we became like brothers, you know, we became really close. He was a great inspiration to me inspired me to do more singing and to write songs, and he was just a good motivator and spirit to me as well, because of his love for God and his Krishna religion. He was just very very a loving person and compassionate guy, and it was just a great thrill to be around him. He encouraged me a lot.
Billy Preston, what can you tell us about how the concert for Bangladesh came to happen? Were you involved with the conception of the event?
Well, yes. In fact, he called me. I was the first one that he called, and he asked me to do it. And I said, of course, I'd be glad to. And then he called everybody, and that was just a great thing to happen. It was the first time anything like that had ever happened. Mm. And all the musicians and the people were just so thrilled to play with each other, because, normally you don't get a chance to play together because everybody's working.
Right, and it came together so quickly. Lots of musicians donated their time, canceled other... Eric Clapton, Bob Dylan, they disappeared from the scene and came out for this event. Was there something about George Harrison as a person that inspired them and you to respond to this effort?
Yes, it was just because of George's compassion. He had compassion for the people in Bangladesh. And, and when George, George is so loving and everybody loved him. So anything George asks you, you're just willing to do, because there was such a good spirit about it all.
Yeah. What was it like for the musicians on stage in rehearsal? Did everybody get along?
Oh, man, yes, definitely. There was no egos. It was, everybody supported each other. It was, just very exciting to be able to play with each other, it was very emotional, very emotional. We did two shows, and it was just fantastic.
Billy Preston, was it difficult at that time to present a program with so much explicitly spiritual music to a rock audience in that kind of psychedelic free love era in 1971?
Well, yes, it was, but that's how bold George was, that's how brave he was. He believed in it, and he wanted to share it, and he wanted, he wanted everybody to get a chance to witness and experience something, spiritual. Mm. And he did it in a nice way. He did it very well with the Indian musicians, and it was the first time that had ever happened.
Ravi Shankar and his
Yes, and he had like 40 musicians, 40 Indian musicians.
Wow.
You know,
a whole new thing.
Yeah. It was a fantastic tour, you know.
Did that spiritual message have a lasting impact? Did you see it show up in more music after the concert for Bangladesh?
Well, yes. I mean, all of his songs had some kind of spiritual base to it. Even in the early days, you know, he was always had something, you know, very spiritual in it. Even he wasn't aware of it, you know. Mm. But just this, the way kind of guy he was, you know, he had such a heart, and it was just great. I remember when we did My Sweet Lord.
Yeah.
In fact, I was very angry when they tried to sue him because he didn't try to copy anybody's song. In fact, we were on tour with Bonnie and Delaney, and we were in the dressing room, and there was a piano there, and he asked us, how do you write a gospel song? So I was playing the piano, and I was playing, you know, like a gospel riff.
Mm-hmm.
And Bonnie and Delaney just started saying, oh, my Lord, and hallelujah, and that's how that started.
And there was, he had to deal with plagiarism charges later, but you saw it born right there.
Yes, it was born right there.
There was, of course, difficulty getting some of the money raised in those concerts to the people of Bangladesh. But did you end up feeling the concert was a success? Did it provide relief, or was it more about raising awareness?
Well, it was about both. But it was kind of sad that the money didn't. They had a problem trying to get the money to the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, he was kind of discouraged by it, disgusted by it. You know, because he wanted it all to go and different companies were trying to get their hands on it. In fact, he kind of said, we should have done two concerts, one for us and one for them.
Right. Billy Preston, what can you tell us about George Harrison's more recent years? Have you remained close with him, been in touch?
Well, I hadn't seen him in a while. You know, I mean, after he had his son and, you know, his family life. And he's very reclusive. He likes to garden and, he's a private person. And I didn't get a chance to speak to him. Of course, I moved, and he changes his number all the time. So we didn't get a chance to talk a lot.
Right.
In the later years. The last time I saw him was I was on tour with Ringo.
Yeah.
And he came to the show.
Yeah. What do you think George Harrison's lasting impact will be in his life, music?
His music and his God and his spirituality. I think that's two of the strongest points of George. And his humbleness, you know, he wasn't affected by the popularity and all. He just loved God, loved music and his family and friends.
Why can't we be humble like the good Lord said? He promised to exalt us, but lo is the way. How men be so greedy when there's so much left. All things God give us, and they all have been blessed. That's the way God planned it. That's the way.
Billy Preston played keyboards with the Beatles, co-produced two albums with George Harrison, and performed with him at the concert for Bangladesh. He spoke to us earlier today from Los Angeles.
God planned it.
How will you remember George Harrison? How does his music resonate with you in these troubled times? The number to call tonight is 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. David Spiro joins us now from Cleveland, Ohio. He's Vice President of Education and Public Programs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Good evening, David Spiro.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're well. Thanks very much for joining us.
Nice hearing Billy. You know, he's had his own health struggles of late as well, so... Here's wishing him the best, too.
Yeah, great to hear him talk today and great to hear that old recording. He really had it.
Oh, yeah.
David Spiro, we're remembering George Harrison tonight, particularly in a time of war, a new kind of war, and remembering him as a new kind of musician. We're going to talk about his music, but I hope you'll take us back for a minute here and talk with us about his initiative with the concert for Bangladesh. It became sort of the pattern for lots of all-star charity rock concerts later. But what was the story behind the concert for Bangladesh?
Well, you know, at the time, no one had ever done anything like that. And I can remember seeing the first ads for it in the New York Times, and it listed, you know, George Harrison and Bob Dylan, mm-hmm. and Ringo Starr and Billy Preston and Leon Russell and Ravi Shankar and
Eric Clapton.
Sure, Eric Clapton and, you know, a bunch of other names on there that, you know, we all knew from recordings. And they were all going to be there at the same time. And it was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, what are they going to do? And, you know, Bangladesh had been in the news. And, you know, unless you were someone that was really paying attention to what was going on, you know, it wasn't in the forefront here in the United States, that's for sure.
Right. Pakistan had fought between the East Pakistan, or now
right.
Bangladesh, and the West, what's currently Pakistan, and a lot of suffering and death had come out of that.
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, close to home that all is right now.
It sure is.
But, you know, the concert took place August 1st, 1971, and as Billy said, they did two shows. And I pulled out my old album of you know, the Bangladesh album, and
mm-hmm.
just reading the notes while Billy was talking. It's, at the end, it says that 44 microphones were used at one time to record this. And you think that not only was the whole concept of doing that sort of concert primitive, but so was the recording technique.
Do you know how George Harrison came up with the idea? Did this grow directly out of his interest in Eastern mysticism and therefore his awareness of what was going on in that part of the world?
I think it was probably brought to him by Ravi Shankar, mm-hmm. Who certainly had, you know, was much more involved, I think, in what was happening at that time.
And was Bengali right next door to Bangladesh.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's my remembrance that he was the one that brought it to George's attention, you know, in what I've read. And that, you know, the original plan was, I think Ravi Shankar figured they could go raise, you know, $50,000, $60,000. And, you know, he called George, and then George called Ringo, and then he called, Eric Clapton. And the next thing they knew, you know, they had a pretty big deal going on there. And even, you know, Bob Dylan, who at that time was even more reclusive than any of those people, you know, to show up on stage with them was a pretty big deal.
And not only show up, but sing a lot of songs.
Oh, yeah.
A big part of the concert was Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the disc that came out, I think, was three discs. So you got side six, and, you know, Dylan did Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. He did It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry. He did Blowin' in the Wind. He did Mr. Tambourine Man. He did Just Like a Woman. I mean, you know, he was out on, you know, he basically did a half a set out there.
How responsible was George Harrison for bringing these sounds of the East to the West?
Well, I think tremendously. You know, I'm not sure we would have heard the sitar in any way, shape, or form if he hadn't introduced it. And, you know, especially on a song like Norwegian Wood, mm-hmm. where, you know, we didn't know what this sound was. And when he first was taking the Beatles over to India, and they were meeting with the Maharishi and listening to that music, I mean, you know, he actually brought these instruments, and the sitar is supposedly the toughest instrument there is on earth to master.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly had a supreme teacher in Ravi Shankar. But he did, and he spent time with, and he brought that sound to those Beatle records. And you know, on Sgt. Pepper, it's Within You, Without You. You know, it's a prime instrument. I don't think we could listen and think about Norwegian Wood without the sitar sound on it.
It's maybe a measure of how much the world has shrunk, that today to hear of Indian music is not at all surprising or remarkable, but then it really was an innovation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it led to things like Paul Simon doing Graceland and bringing African music into it. You know, it just opened so many different doors. And it wasn't just the sitar. I mean, you know, we hadn't heard a tabla or a tambour on a record. And, you know, he was bringing these things to the Beatle records, and also bringing those artists, you know, a Ravi Shankar would have gotten lost in this country as a musician. But, you know, George gave him a forum to play in front of millions and millions of people.
To have one of the Beatles stand up for you made it entirely different.
Oh, absolutely.
David Spiro, hang on. We're talking about George Harrison and his legacy. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. How did George Harrison affect your youth, your life, your appreciation of music and the world? Here's the song Bangladesh from The Concert for Bangladesh. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We're talking about George Harrison this hour. Here's Paul McCartney remembering his fellow Beatle earlier today.
He's a lovely guy, very brave man, beautiful sense of humour. He's really just my baby brother. He'll be missed sorely by all his friends and loved ones.
Since he's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but I'm to blame, it's plain to see. So go away. Believe that she would leave me on my own. It's just all right when every night I'm all alone. I've got no time for you right now. Don't bother me. I know I'll never be the same if I don't get her back again.
Don't Bother Me, George Harrison's first song written for the Beatles. We're talking about George Harrison and his legacy tonight. He wrote songs of peace in an earlier time of war. How do they sound to you now? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by David Sparrow. He's Vice President of Education and Public Programs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. David Sparrow, there's a very early song from George Harrison. He was 19 when he joined the Beatles, famously the youngest Beatle, and just 27 when the band split up in 1970. Tell us the story of how George Harrison joined the Beatles.
Well, you know, I think going back to the song you just played, the Don't Bother Me song, I think that pretty much sums things up for where he was at. I mean, you know, he was probably the one that didn't embrace Beatledom as much as certainly Paul and Ringo and in some you know respects John. Mm-hmm. You know, he really the whole rock star thing I think wasn't anything he ever was looking out for, and you know, I think he wanted to just go and play his music. And in later days when he was doing the stuff with the Traveling Wilburys, and it was him and Bob Dylan and Tom Petty and Roy Orbison, mm-hmm. and Jeff Lynne and that band, you know, that might have really been his best times personally, you know, to make music, because it was just so free and easy, no pressure. He knew he didn't have to go do a tour. He didn't have to go do press. They could just go in the studio and create these songs and then make mm-hmm. just tremendous music.
Looking back in 1995, George Harrison said mm-hmm. about the fans and the crazy times in the 60s, he said they gave their money and they gave their screams. But the Beatles kind of gave their nervous systems. They used us as an excuse to go mad, the world did, and then blamed it on us.
Yeah, I think that's pretty true. And even if you look at the movies, you know, in Hard Day's Night, he's a half step back from the other guys. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah, he takes part of in all the zaniness, and I'm sure he certainly appreciated what they were doing. But I think the whole rock star, you know, attitude was certainly not George Harrison. And the fact that he barely toured after the Beatles, you know, he did one tour, I think it was probably in 74 or something like that. And then he toured Japan with Eric Clapton at one time. And that was really about it. I mean, you hear about Ringo doing his All-Star tours mm-hmm. every other year. And, you know, Paul's done Wings and Paul McCartney tours. And, you know, George never fell into that pattern. I don't think he ever felt that was what he needed to do. I was just watching one of the news reports earlier, and they had a clip of him sitting in the studio saying, you know, I'm just quite as happy to go out and plant a tree in the garden as I am to put a guitar solo down on tape.
The quiet Beatle, and yet they brought him in initially because he was such a guitarist.
Sure.
We're talking about George Harrison with David Sparrow from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How do you see George Harrison's influence on music, on society? Joe's on the line. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Joe.
How are you?
We're good, thanks.
Great show. Hey, the point I wanted to make is a comment, but I'd like your take on it, is that it seems to me that, you know, you look at Lennon and McCartney's career after the Beatles broke up, and
mm-hmm.
they were good musical careers, but certainly nothing compared to the Beatles. And in the 80s, I cannot remember the song, but Harrison had a minor hit. And when I first heard it, it struck me that this was kind of the magic ingredient of the Beatles that I had never really realized before, that Harrison just had this kind of quality to him that really kind of made the Beatles special. And I wondered...
Let's put that to David Spero. He did have a magic quality. David Spero, how would you characterize it?
Yeah, I think the song you're talking about is the song he wrote about John Lennon. It's totally escaping my mind right now, but he did have a hit with the song. And in fact, he brought Ringo and Paul together on that song, which was the first time the three of them had actually performed together in the studio in any way, shape, or form. But I think their magic was the four of them. And I think everyone had an equal part in making that magic work. It was the songwriting, it was the playing, it was the arranging, it was the harmonies, it was George Martin's production, it was George Martin's string and horn arrangements, it was George Harrison's guitar licks, and you know, he learned from the best. I mean, he studied the Carl Perkins records, and he studied the Little Richard records, and learned how to make the most. You didn't hear long, involved guitar solos from mm-hmm. George Harrison. Mm-hmm. He could make it work with just little pieces and riffs here and there.
Yeah, it was all four, but here's Joe saluting the magic that George Harrison brought to it. And thanks
Absolutely.
For your, thanks for your call, Joe. We want to break down this music a little bit. Of course, in Norwegian Wood was where George Harrison really put his mark on it, bringing in the sitar. Let's play the song Norwegian Wood,
sure.
and here you can tell us about George Harrison's influence.
I wanted a girl, or should I say, she wants like me. She showed me her room.
Norwegian Wood, the Beatles, and of course with George Harrison. Show us, talk to us there, David Spero, about George Harrison's influence in Norwegian Wood.
Well, here you've got, you know, basically a simple song with an acoustic guitar that John Lennon wrote, and it's a song where John's basically telling his wife Cynthia that their relationship is over and telling her the story of meeting this other woman who is, of course, Yoko Ono.
Mm-hmm.
And George, you know, comes through with really the signature of the song, which is the sitar.
Right. Suddenly here's all of India dancing in the background.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of gives it this whole mystical feeling to the song. And you know, when you think of, listen to John's lyric about, you know, having to sleep in the bath and you hear this sitar clanging away in the background, and you know, it kind of just takes it and the storytelling to a different level because of the music.
It was part of the Beatles' mystique that they had this Eastern mysticism aura around them, and that really was George Harrison's contribution, wasn't it?
Absolutely. A month or so ago, I was very fortunate and got to present Sir George Martin, the Beatles producer, on stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and that was one of the songs we were talking about. And, you know, he talked about George first bringing this instrument in the studio and everybody just kind of looking at him with, like, disbelief.
And then taking the Beatles all the way to India to meet with Maharishi Mahesh
sure.
Yogi. George Harrison himself was a longtime devotee of Hare Krishna.
Right. Right. And you know, a very spiritual person. And, you know, his lyrics from day one have always shown that. And, you know, when he did My Sweet Lord, it was pretty unheard of at that time for a rock star to go out and make a giant religious statement like that.
A lot of spirituality suddenly fused with pop music. David Spiro, stand by. I want to bring Tim Riley into the conversation to join us now. Tim Riley is a music critic and author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles Commentary.
A very cool book, too.
Oh, good. Hello, Tim Riley.
Hi. Thanks, David.
Hi, Tim.
Thank you for
that book.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, thank you for joining us, Tim Riley. We're just talking about the Beatles music and, in particular, the influence of George Harrison. We just listened to Norwegian Wood. How would you describe George Harrison's music in that song and over time on what the world came to understand the Beatles to be?
Yeah. Well, his contribution to the Beatles, as David pointed out, was very important because he brought in sort of what we now would call the world music element, but in those days was a very exotic and different and foreign-sounding thing to appear in a rock band, and it was part of the Beatles' overall eclecticism, but George Harrison used it as a way of securing his own voice in the band. And, of course, he had John Lennon and Paul McCartney, two very creative, genius songwriters, very prolific. He had a lot to fight through in order for his voice to be heard on Beatle albums. So one of the ways he did it was because of his embrace of Indian mysticism and the instrumentation and adopting Ravi Shankar as a mentor. Mm. And another way he did it was by developing his songwriting so that he was there and kind of working like a sponge inside the Beatles and soaking up everything that Lennon and McCartney had to teach him in terms of songwriting. So at the beginning, his songs were tentative and not up to par, not up to the Lennon and McCartney par. But by the end, by Abbey Road with songs like Here Comes the Sun and Something, he was really an equal with them. So here's the story of a guy who found himself in a band with the two greatest songwriters of his generation and really
stepped up to it.
Stepped up to it, exactly.
Yeah, there's a clip I heard today with George where he was talking about getting a songwriting tip from John Lennon. And John told him, you know, it's very important to see your idea through. And as soon as, you know, once you start working on the song, finish it. Don't let it sit there for days and fester while you've got it going, while you've got the feeling going for it, you know, take it to the end.
Stay with it.
And he said, you know, with songs like Yesterday or with Something and Here Comes the Sun, that was the first time he felt that he really had achieved that.
Tim Riley, we're going to play the song For You Blue. Talk about us. Talk to us about George Harrison's expression here. George Harrison in For You Blue. Tim Riley?
Well, that's an example of George's lightheartedness, a very simple blues track that's set up by a rather ingenious and opening guitar solo that's in a completely different key than the rest of the song, which is a very Beatlesque kind of thing to do. Tricks the ear as to where the song, what key the song is going to land in, and also invoking the name Elmore James in the middle of the song, which harkens back to even pre-rhythm and blues roots that the Beatles were adopting there in their Let It Be sessions.
The Beatles drew a lot from R&B and from the black tradition in the United States.
Well, I've heard some very persuasive arguments that in the beginning the Beatles really were a very sort of hardcore rhythm and blues band, even more than they were a pop band. Of course, we had two different scenes there when the Beatles emerged from Liverpool. In London, the blues scene was really the hottest, hippest thing going. But in Liverpool, the beat music they were making was heavily derived from a different tradition, and that was R&B and singers like Arthur Alexander and the girl groups. And they had sort of a different embrace of pop music than the blues purists in London.
David Spiro, Tim Riley, I'd like to hear you both on George Harrison's guitar playing. We've talked about the sitar and Indian influence. When we think of rock guitarists from the 60s and 70s, you know, Hendrix and Clapton come to mind for their kind of wailing sound. What was Harrison's influence on the guitar front?
I think, you know, him bringing the slide guitar to the front, you know, you heard it on that, on an acoustic guitar. You know, as a slide guitar player, I think he's probably unequaled.
And I would say that his contribution is rather ironic in rock and roll terms, especially because he's rather a humble lead guitar player, and he's the one who brings Eric Clapton into a Beatles session to play on his song While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that shows a great deal of modesty and generosity and a confidence in his own ability. And, of course, he was very influential, and he brought out a lot of new sounds, a Day Tripper, Ticket to Ride. Those sounds and the guitar that he was creating, he was really at the vanguard of the electric guitar-driven pop song in the mid-60s.
And also bringing the backwards guitar into play in songs like Rain and, you know, even earlier on than that, he had done it two or three times.
Backward guitar, what's that?
Well, he'd record a solo or he'd record a guitar part, and I think if you listen to Dr. Robert or something like that, you'll hear when they actually used it on the record, they took the tape literally backwards and played it backwards on the song.
George Martin, the producer, was influential in that as well, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
David Spiro, we know you've got to go. We thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for including me.
It was great to have you. David Spiro is with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for being with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Tim Riley, we're going to go out soon listening to Something. Give us the background on this. This was, of course, a huge song for George Harrison.
Well, it was a very big hit. It was the first A-side to a single that he had as a hit, and it was a number one hit. It's one of the few Harrison songs that's included on last year's best-selling, worldwide best-selling collection of Beatle number one hits. And ironically, because Frank Sinatra was a rock and roll basher, this is one of the rock and roll songs that Frank Sinatra embraced by mistakenly attributing it to Lennon and McCartney, but it was actually a George Harrison song.
And he was writing about?
Well, he was writing about his wife, Patty, who he met on the set of Hard Day's Night in 1964.
Also Eric Clapton's wife.
And who later became Eric Clapton's wife and was the subject of Eric Clapton's song, Layla.
George Harrison's Something.
I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how. Somewhere in her smile, she knows that I don't need no other lover. Something in her style.
We're talking about George Harrison and his lasting legacy. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. For a look back at George Harrison's life in words and photos, check out our website, WBOR.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook.
George Harrison playing My Sweet Lord from the Concert for Bangladesh. We're talking about George Harrison this hour. He died yesterday at age 58, last joined the Beatles, 19 when they made their first recording in 1962, only 27 when the group split up in 1970. We're joined by Tim Riley. He's a music critic and author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary. Tim Riley, we talked earlier with David Spiro about the concert for Bangladesh. The subcontinent, this part of the world, is back on our minds these days. Does it surprise you that it was George who made this happen? Tim Riley, are you there?
I'm back now.
Sorry, Tim.
That's okay.
We're just looking back at the concert for Bangladesh and the fact that George Harrison brought this whole region of the world into the kind of mass media pop music arena. Does that surprise you?
Well, it doesn't surprise me because he had actually gone there and visited there, and Ravi Shankar was his mentor. And he had been studying with Ravi Shankar for several years by that point. And Shankar came to him and said, you know, these people are really suffering. This has been a terrible civil war, and we really need some help. And Harrison knew the kind of influence he could wield among his peers and with his audience, and he threw the concert for Bangladesh, which was really the first successful large-scale rock benefit effort. I mean, the other thing that is important about Bangladesh and has to do with the rest of Harrison's career is that he brought Bob Dylan out of retirement to perform at the concert for Bangladesh. And Bob Dylan played, he was a very good friend of George Harrison's, and he played five songs there, and it's a very important set for Bob Dylan. It really is Bob Dylan's first big comeback since his 1968 motorcycle accident. And the careers of Dylan and Harrison are intertwined and very importantly related to each other.
Each bringing the other out when they were gone and down.
Exactly. And they co-wrote a song together that Harrison performed on his first solo album after the Beatles. And his first solo album after the Beatles was a really remarkable moment for his career because nobody expected him to put out two full LPs full of songs produced by Phil Spector. Mm-hmm. And we were really taken aback because here was this guy who got one or two songs per record, and all of a sudden his first solo album is a double set, and it's a very strong record. And there were headlines like, you know, maybe George always was the best songwriter. He really trumped expectations with that move, and he never really quite lived up to that in the same way again.
Tim Riley, hang on. I want to bring in a caller or two. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking about George Harrison, dead yesterday at 58. Daniel is on the line. Welcome, Daniel.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Wanted just to tell a brief little story that when I was 14 years old, I scraped together all the money I possibly could and bought two tickets to see the Dark Horse concert in the Boston Garden. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very disappointed. It was only half sold out, and there was all this Indian music, and I just couldn't relate to it. But since I had spent all my money, I thought, God, I've got to get the album, try to figure this out. What's this all about?
Yeah.
And I ended up buying the Dark Horse album, and there was a picture in there of Krishna and Arjuna on the Gita cover.
Sure.
And I listened to that over and over again, and it had a very kind of strong, subtle influence on me, and I ended up hitchhiking to India at 17 years old through Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan.
We know
the path. I ended up living in India and marrying an Indian. And, you know, I think a lot of that can be attributed just to the songs of George Harrison.
It's a dangerous thing to go to a concert when you're 14 years old and hear George Harrison. I guess you do. Daniel, thank you so much for your call and your story. Tim Riley, there's the George Harrison experience in a nutshell. Go to a concert, end up in India, married to an Indian woman.
Yeah, well, that 1974 tour was sort of roundly panned by critics because he rehearsed so hard for it and went out so quickly and did so many dates per week that his throat was very quickly quite ragged and sore, and he sang his voice out very quickly. And I heard that tour when it came to Denver, and I thought the critics got it wrong. I mean, I think he brought out Ravi Shankar for the first half and just said, here's, you know, we're going to listen to Indian music for the first half of this show. And then he came out and played a rock and roll second half, and the rock and roll was very powerful and effective, and the band was very tight, and he did a very warm, powerful, evocative rearrangement of John Lennon's song In My Life. Again, a very generous move, playing his bandmate song within his solo set. And it did have this effect on people, because people didn't really want to go, they didn't pay money to hear Ravi Shankar, but Harrison had them sit and listen to Ravi Shankar. It was, you, if you wanted to hear Harrison, this was the deal. You had to sit and listen
that
to
Shankar.
That
was the price of admission.
And it really opened up a lot of people's ears, you know, because it's a very different kind of music, a lot of different expectations, and a very different
listening requirements.
Tim Riley, we've just got a minute left, but talk to us about George Harrison's spiritual side. It comes up again and again in its origins and its expression.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the neat things about the late George Harrison career is the way he kind of helps invent geezer rock with the Traveling Wilburys. And it's this very lighthearted, genial, you know, again, generous and gathering friends around him. And they're writing songs about what it feels like to be aging and putting your teeth in a glass at night and yet still in love with rock and roll and still wanting to boogie down and stuff. And it's a very, very sweet effort. And it brings out the best side of him, which was very peaceful, very spiritual, very calming, very reassuring, and a very light touch. That's the best side of George Harrison.
Tim Riley, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Tim Riley is author of Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary. We've been talking about George Harrison. Here's Give Me Love, Give Me Peace on Earth by George Harrison from the CD Live in Japan. Harrison, we won't forget him. And now, as we do each Friday night, we're going to take a look back at the events of this week. In a moment, I'll be joined by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. But first, the sounds of the week.
No president or commander-in-chief hopes anybody loses life in the theater, but it's going to happen. I believe the American people understand that we've got a mighty struggle on our hands and that there will be sacrifice.
11 weeks ago, our country was attacked. Tonight, the tide has turned. This fight is over for the Al-Qaeda. This fight is over for the Taliban.
Finally, after 3 days of a nightmarish battle, Kali Jangi Fort opens up its gates and we see the horror of what happened. A Northern Alliance soldier surveys the damage, just a few of the hundreds killed in a three-day orgy of violence.
Welcome to Winfield, Alabama, the night the war came home. Most in this town of just over 4,000 didn't know 32-year-old Mike Spann was in the CIA.
He gave his life in the line of duty, and our family wants the world to know that we are very proud of our son, Mike, and we consider him a hero.
I just thank the Lord Jesus Christ for getting us out and answering all those prayers, and just thankful to all the people that prayed, and to the American military did an incredible job of getting us out. Thanks a lot.
The use of embryos to clone is wrong. We should not, as a society, grow life to destroy it.
And what we've been hearing just in the last few minutes is that there's general agreement towards bringing Afghanistan to some sort of democracy, and what a task that's going to be, trying to reestablish the rule of law.
The former Beatle, George Harrison, has died of cancer in Los Angeles at the age of 58.
We grew up with the Beatles. You know, their music and the band, the personalities of the band were the background to our lives. And so I think people will be very sad at his death. And so he will be very, very sadly missed by people right around the world.
Sounds from the week. Jack Beatty, we're getting used to a kind of bath of dramatic language and real moments just week after week. There it is again.
There it is again. The first American combat death
a man from Alabama who was in the CIA, a former Marine.
Johnny Spann.
And, yeah, one hopes this is not going to be repeated. Interestingly, he was a CIA man at that fortress, Kala Jangi Fortress, in Afghanistan, where there was the riot.
And Mazar-e-Sharif.
Some people think the riot, there's some accounts stress that the riots were set off, these were Taliban prisoners, were set off by the fear among the Taliban, first that they were being interviewed by CIA men, but more importantly that they were going to be executed, that their surrender was a surrender to execution, not at the American hands, but at the hands of the Northern Alliance. And this, of course, raises the whole issue of the treatment of prisoners in Afghanistan and our role in, you know, we're perhaps the only force that can say to the Northern Alliance, no, you've got to treat these prisoners well. And there have been reports of, you know, there was one Northern Alliance group reportedly executed 160 Taliban soldiers. The New York Times reported that a convoy of trucks of 800 soldiers sort of was disappearing someplace. This is bad stuff, and it may well be the U.S. will have to have more presence on the ground, either of its own forces or European forces, to prevent the killing of prisoners, which is a violation of the laws of war.
Yeah, Jack, I guess the question that's rising over all of this is whether the standards of wartime behavior are being changed willy-nilly or deliberately in Washington's wrath over the September 11th terrorist attacks.
Well, of course, there are domestic people here at home saying that that's happening in the Justice Department, and the changing the idea of trying convicted or suspected terrorists in military courts, that this is a kind of abandonment of the American tradition of justice. It has justification, the Justice Department thinks, for sufficient reasons. But, yeah, there is a kind of coarsening that happens in war, and the polls show that the public overwhelmingly supports a very tough line with even suspected terrorists, and any civil liberties qualms seem to be muted.
For the moment, we heard in the sound clip the Marines coming into Afghanistan saying, this fight is over for the al-Qaeda, and the anger is still out there, and that's being acted out in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and now comes the hard part, according to the military people, the actual hunting through the caves of Tora Bora, an area of a remote area south of Jalalabad, for bin Laden, for Taliban, for some of his forces. And this is where U.S. casualties might well rise.
Of course, the president's saying, be ready for this, and that he believes Americans are ready for it. Do you think he's got that right?
The polls say that the public is ready for casualties. And we're not facing a mass army situation here, you know, where there'd be thousands of casualties inflicted in a day, nothing like a kind of slugging match, army to army. But you could well have more, you know, incidents where two, three people are seriously wounded or killed. And that's going to be, talk about sacrifice. That's the ultimate sacrifice for American families.
That's it. Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.